Page 943 is the whole of Matthew 26, isn't it? So if you look in the fourth column, you'll see verse 63. So page 943, column 4, verse 6. This is sounding a bit like Wordle now, isn't it? Page 943, column 4, verse 63. And Mike's going to read a little bit of that chunk there. And then he's going to tell us when he jumps to a different bit of chapter 27. Are you exhausted just listening to all that? Okay, so verse 63.
But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. And we move now to verse 11 of chapter 27. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Christ?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. When Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message, "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ?" Pilate asked. They all answered, "Crucify him." "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him!" When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." All the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified.
Thanks, Mike. Now, if you're a child of the 70s, and I'm in good company today, you might remember a series called Crown Court. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Don't make me sing the theme tune, but you remember it, right? It went like this, didn't it? Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Do you remember that? Yes, it's all flooding back. So it was a drama series, and what was odd about it was this. It was 12 randomly selected members of the public served as a real jury in a fake trial, if you see what I mean. So what happened was this. The jury were real members of the public, but the trial itself was scripted, and all the other parts were played by actors. So the judge, the barristers, the wicked defendant, the lying witnesses, and so on. And at the end of each mini-series of two or three episodes, the jury of real members of the public had to decide in real time whether it was guilty or not guilty. And I was a bit young to follow what was going on, but it was compelling stuff. Now, more recently, there was another series called Kavanaugh QC. Does that ring any bells? John Thor was Kavanaugh QC. And to be honest, any courtroom portrayal of a trial on TV or in a film has very familiar features. The defendant is almost always represented. The judge is almost always infuriatingly fair. The jury almost always reaches a balanced verdict. This morning, we've had read to us verses which describe those moments when Jesus stood before, first of all, the high priest, and then Pontius Pilate, and was condemned. Now, in effect, this was Jesus' trial. In effect, because it wasn't a trial in the court as we would recognize it, with legal representation, witnesses, legal argument, counter-argument, leading to a verdict or a judgment. But it was a trial nevertheless, because it featured accusation and condemnation. And we'll look at the sequence of events in a moment. But before we do, a bit of legal practice. I'm a barrister by trade, and sometimes in my job we suggest a particular outcome to a judge. And when we do that, we draw up a table of benefits and burdens. So in what we might call a medical treatment case, if Mr. X has this course of complicated but risky medical treatment, the benefits could be as follows, and we set them out. But it carries risk, and if it goes wrong, the burdens could be as follows, and we set them out. So we set out the benefits and the burdens. If Mrs. X stays in her own home, the benefits could be as follows. But she's elderly and she's infirm, she's 85, and if she stays in her own home at that age, the burdens could be as follows. So we draw up a list of balancing factors, the benefits and the burdens. With that in mind, I've looked at this account, first of all before the high priest, then before Pontius Pilate, and it seems to me that Jesus took various decisions. Each one of them was a burden. For example, one of the most striking features of his trial, or if you like, of his two trials, is his firm decision to remain essentially silent. Now, sometimes lawyers practicing in criminal law will advise their clients not to go into the witness box and give evidence. And that's for the good reason that by the time it's the defendant's turn to give evidence, the prosecution plainly hasn't proved its case as the case has gone along. And as we say in the trade, there is no case to answer. Sometimes the lawyer will advise the client not to go into the witness box and give evidence because the lawyer knows that the client will be such a hopeless witness that it's best to keep the client out of the witness box. But usually, there is a good reason for a client to give his or her version of events. And trust me, most clients are usually desperate to give their version of events, having heard the other side's twisted version of events. But what did Jesus do? He remained steadfastly silent, except in one critical sense. To use an old-fashioned phrase that we sometimes use in the law, he condemned himself out of his own mouth. Verse 63, "Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. how much easier would it have been for him to say, no, not the Son of God, there's been a misunderstanding, and to compromise at that point? How much easier would it have been for Jesus to cut a deal? But by confirming, I am the Son of God, and otherwise by remaining silent, what does he do? Well, he voluntarily takes on a burden, a load, if you like. Now, had he been represented at this trial, most, if not all, lawyers would say, give your account, say something to defend yourself, give me something to go on, or at least let me mitigate for you. Let me give me reasons why I can ask for a reduced sentence. And the lawyer's motive would be a good one. No one wants to see their client suffer an undue sentencing burden or be convicted on flimsy evidence. Let me test the evidence for you, says the lawyer. And I don't want this to sound discourteous, but I think Jesus would have been quite a challenging client. Full of grace, no doubt. Full of gratitude, no doubt. But ultimately stubborn. He would say nothing in his defense. Indeed, he would offer reasons to convict himself. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say. And if a well-intentioned lawyer had said to him, just give me something to work on, he would be met with silence. And we have a saying in the law, anyone who represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, doesn't that fit this particular dilemma? And anyway, Jesus had chances to reflect on his position, because he had essentially two separate trials. Just take a moment, we sometimes say to clients. Walk it round the block, sleep on it, come back to me. But there was no changing his mind, and I think the point of that is this. Jesus was not in the business of justifying. He was not in the business of explaining or apologizing, and he was not in the business of asking for mercy or a reduced sentence. His decision? Take on the burden. And it was only going to get worse after he was handed over by the high priest. Verse 67, then they spat in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you? Perhaps that would have been the moment to ask for a deal. But in that interval, between the high priest, that's the high priest of his own people, don't forget, condemning him, and him appearing next before the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, what does Jesus do? Well, he grits his teeth and he adds to his own burdens. Chapter 27, verse 11. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Yes, he replies, it is as you say. So this is a new accuser now. This is the Roman governor. This is Pontius Pilate. Any lawyer looking at this by now has his head in his hands. Don't make things worse. And the music in the background is getting more and more gloomy. Jesus knew that he had to go through a trial. He knew he had to be flogged. He knew what the ultimate sentence would be, but what did he refuse to do? He refused to relieve the burden on himself. Films have been made about this series of trials. Charlton Heston in The Robe, you might have seen. More recently, The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson. I think that was about 15 years ago. By the way, The Passion, in that context, doesn't mean something we feel strongly about. It comes from the Latin word to suffer. So the passion of the Christ means the suffering of the Christ. And if you've watched it, you'll remember, I think, that one of the things it captures particularly well is the almost total loneliness of Jesus during this stretched out ordeal. Very few people watching these events had any clue about who he really was. To the crowd, it was just sport to choose Barabbas over Jesus. And the shouts of crucify him, well, that's just crowds doing what crowds do. No one cares. And the Roman soldiers flogging him, very, very difficult to watch in the film. Mel Gibson, I think, really brings verse 26 to life. Then he released Barabbas to them, but he, that's Pontius Pilate, had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. It goes on for ages, and there is blood everywhere. The only person in authority who seems to be remotely troubled by this is Pilate and his wife. His wife tipped him off in verse 19 of chapter 27. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message. Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. Does Pilate throw Jesus a lifeline? No. Pilate realizes he's swimming against the political tide. And we all know what he does. Having appealed to the crowd, what crime has he committed? He took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood. It is your responsibility. And note what Jesus doesn't do. He doesn't try to explain himself to Pilate. He doesn't throw himself on Pilate's mercy. On his own shoulders stays the burden. And what I think the film The Passion does really well is to steer clear of making Jesus a hero at this point. What you get instead is a really strong sense of bleakness and of his being totally alone. You can feel the burden of his loneliness. You can feel the burden of his being condemned. The chief priests had handed Jesus over to Pilate. They had complied with the law, done their duty, satisfied their own people. The crowd, well, it was keeping itself entertained. Pilate, he'd done his bit, washed his hands, had other things to get on with. Everyone was moving on. There is no one to comfort Jesus. No one has access to him. He has no lawyer. His disciples are very much on the edge of all of this until the crucifixion itself. And there wasn't going to be that moment where everybody says, "What have we done?" This is the one week in the year, I think, when we need to think long and hard. If we claim Jesus as our Savior, think long and hard about the trial. The trial in its narrow sense of the legal procedure, and the trial in the broader sense. Another word for that would be ordeal, which the dictionary defines as a prolonged, painful, or horrific experience. And the upside-down nature of all of this is that Jesus didn't go through the legal trial and the sentence of death because he had committed an offence which merited that sentence. Quite the reverse. All of Scripture says that he was totally innocent. His crime, such as it was to affirm that he was the Son of God. And over those few days and nights, that was nothing but a burden. And we know how it ends. The painful walk slash crawl to Calvary with the cross over his shoulders, nails through hands and feet, breathlessness and agony, probably, possibly for hours, and death. And for why? Well, the answer is this. Jesus took the burden, and we take the benefit. He took all of the burden, we take all of the benefit. And that right there is the beating heart of the gospel. Jesus taking the burden of our sins, and us in exchange taking the benefit of forgiveness. Now, when you go home later on and you watch the news and you see the bodies piling up in Ukraine. And I think for me, the most affecting photograph of the week was that little boy of maybe six standing by his mother's grave, refusing to leave his mother's graveside, hastily dug in the back garden. When you watch the news, perhaps you'll think, well, a talk about Jesus's trial and his taking the burden of our burden for our benefit, it all sounds a bit marginal, to be honest. It all sounds a bit of an irrelevance. But I think, in fact, the opposite is the case. Two things. First of all, the world has never needed Jesus more. It feels like there's more evil and division and obvious hatred on display than at any other period in my lifetime. Now, maybe that's because, maybe it's a product of the 24-hour news cycle and social media. And of course, parents' generation would have their own memories of the Second World War when things would have felt just as bleak, if not worse. But the atmosphere is grim. And of course, sin, by which we mean breaking God's law, isn't just on terrible display in Ukraine. The Bible tells us that sin crouches at our door. It's Genesis. The world has never needed Jesus more, because only Jesus lifts the burden of our sin. These are not weights that we can lift off ourselves. The burdens he took on at his trial, he took on not for people in general. The gospel is highly personal. He took on those burdens for you, and he took on those burdens for me. The benefit is for you and for me. It's not just a warm, fuzzy idea. The people we rub shoulders with, Monday to Saturday, need to know this. Over there, there's a stone. And at the bottom of the stone, it says that this school, when it was a ragged school, was built to the glory of God and for the welfare of this neighborhood. And that was 1871. That includes making Jesus known by name for what he has done and will do for anyone who asks. And to do that, we have to use actual words. Secondly, those of us who know that our burdens have been lifted, well, what should that produce? Thankful hearts. I'll get a bit personal here, if I may. As you may know, my mum died in January, and I was able to say at her funeral that I would see her again. And I will see her again. Because her burdens had been lifted by Jesus, and she knew she was forgiven and where she was going. So it's been difficult, but I am thankful for her sake that Jesus did not flinch at his appallingly one-sided trial, and that he didn't cut a deal. There is a fantastic hymn by Samuel Crossman, which I think we're going to have in a minute after this. Words by Samuel Crossman, music by John Ireland. It's called My Song is Love Unknown. And it covers these verses that we've been looking at. And so with apologies, I'm not going to sing, don't worry, but with apologies for the poetic English, here is verse 5. This is about the trial, essentially, in the aftermath. They rise and needs will have my dear Lord made away. A murderer they save, that's Barabbas. The Prince of Life they slay. And then here's the guts of it. Yet cheerful he to suffering goes, that he his foes from thence, that suffering, might free. I'm going to read that again. Yet cheerful he to suffering goes, that he his foes from thence might free. And the last verse is the thankful heart verse, verse 6. Here might I stay and sing, no story so divine. Never was love, dear king, never was grief like thine. This is my friend, in whose sweet praise I all my days could gladly spend.